Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. On our show today, kids and money. A lot of parents worry that their kids are missing critical financial skills. They also worry that they're spending too much time on useless apps on a device. Well, perhaps you can deal with both at once. We'll talk to the developers of a new app designed to improve financial literacy in kids. It's called Save the Camp. And will they or won't they go up? What would regulatory changes on embedded commissions do to the cost of investment advice? John DeGuy argues, not so much. Then, one of the robo-advisors is branching out into life insurance. How does it work? And is this the place you want to replace a real live human being? We'll have some tips on decumulation, spending your hard-earned retirement savings, plus the not-so-wonderful world of divorce. I'll talk to the author of a new book called The Path to a Successful Divorce. Let's get started. I'm going to read this in my best movie trailer voice. Here it goes. You're the boss now, and if the flag is stolen, you are fired. You'll be given a daily budget to purchase and upgrade towers, but be careful. Your success will depend on how well you save. That's the description of a new game called Save the Camp. It's designed to help teach kids basic financial skills. And joining me now is Sarah Ray from Meridian Credit Union and Ian Hartland from the Learning Partnership. Ian, how did I do on my promo? Do you think I could advertise it?
It was amazing. Bruce. Yeah, you did a great
job. Tell us about this game and how it works.
Okay, so this game is a tower defense game. I don't know how familiar you are with that kind of
genre. I have a 7-year-old, and she gets very limited screen time, so I don't know what the heck you're talking about.
Okay, well, probably the most famous example of the tower defense genre. No. Plants vs. Zombies?
No.
Okay, so this is a really classic tower defense game. In games like this, players are tasked with building towers to defend against waves of enemies. What we've done is taken that genre of game but put a spin on it. And instead of players being able to buy those towers with cash, we've also allowed them to buy those towers with credit.
Oh, what's the interest rate on the card that you're giving them?
Well, it actually depends. So the way we've set it up is players really have to manage that credit. We're not going to give you enough money in each level to buy all the towers you need to succeed. Instead, you're going to have to play with that credit card and manage the debt. If you pay it off effectively at the end of each level, then your interest rate's going to decrease, your interest rate on your savings is going to increase, etc.
Sarah, this game's targeted at age 7 to 10 years old. What's the specific takeaway that you're going for?
Ooh, we are going for, first and foremost, have fun. Because first and foremost, have a ton of fun. Our kids are, as you said, spending so much time on those devices. We want that, you know, those 10,000 hours that a kid's going to spend by the time they're age 21, you know, video gaming and on their mobile games, we want to turn that into a financial literacy opportunity.
Right. I love that you said have fun because Abby has read a bunch of, this is my 7-year-old, she's read a bunch of books about personal finance, and she will delineate between what are the ones, it's just a book and it happens to talk about money, and what is like the school version of books. So fun is important. Yeah. Of the personal finance lessons, of the financial literacy lessons, what would be a couple of them that you want a student to be able to maybe even recount after playing the game?
Yeah. So it's really, spending wisely, budgeting, and then saving.
Okay, that's good. Now, Ian, there's a bunch of games, there's books, there's apps, there's a whole bunch of stuff already out there. What would you say is unique about this one?
I think what's unique is, first of all, we're really trying our best to blend fun and learning. I remember the types of educational games that I played when I was a kid. This was like Math Blasters. Really, these were like quiz sheets that were dressed up as games, but didn't really have deep game mechanics that make us want to play them. So that's what we've done here. We've actually looked to entertainment titles, games that are purely designed for fun and entertainment, and looked at why those succeed, and then tied those game mechanics to financial literacy lessons.
Sarah, where'd the idea come from? How did Meridian and Learning Partnership come together?
Yeah, we built this game to support our members and our communities. And this topic of this pressing need for our members who are parents in having a tangible solution that can help them to teach their kids about money is something we've heard a lot about, a lot of demand for this type of solution in the last few years. And, you know, even at our last year at our annual member meeting, a passionate parent with a 12-year-old daughter sitting next to him said literally to our CEO, you know, do you have something that can help me to teach my kid about money? My daughter feels she isn't learning much on this topic in her grade 7 classroom. Could you support schools in learning, in, you know, in resolving this issue? And fortunately, we were already underway with the Learning Partnership working to develop this solution.
Ian, why was this an appealing one for Learning Partnership from your standpoint?
Few things. One, financial
money,
literacy.
Cash. You're like, wow, what are we getting out of this? Because you're not for profit, right?
We're not for profit, yeah. But what we generally do is we work between business and education to fill gaps that exist in the school system and support public education by creating these types of solutions. So I think that's where it starts for us, is we knew that there was a gap here in terms of the curriculum. Financial literacy is an area that teachers, they're concerned about. They know it's an important issue for students. But it's not really directly addressed in the curriculum. We're seeing the Ontario Ministry now kind of pivot and add it to a grade 10 course. But in general, it's kind of in this odd spot. So what we want to do is develop resources so that teachers have more options when it comes to addressing these topics.
And where do parents get it? From the App Store?
Yeah, it's totally free. Like you said, we're non-for-profit, right? So the game is completely free due to Meridian's generous support. You can get it on the App Store, on Google Play, and you can also play it in a web browser at savethecamp.ca.
Well, I'm not sure who wants to answer this, but tell me about the experience of you observing kids who are playing it. Or what are you hearing? What are they saying? I mean, you've rolled it out. I'm sure you tested it at least once or twice with a young person.
Yeah, at least once or twice. We held a few focus groups for this. We held a great event in November at St. Joseph's College School here on Wellesley in Toronto. That was a group of grade 9 girls. It's an all-girls school. They loved it. We had really a good time with them, lots of fun. And then throughout the process as well, we had another group of, let's say, 5 or 6 students that consulted with us throughout. A lot of them are, you know, enjoying the game for its kind of fun aspect. Of course, that's what we want. But at the same time, they're coming away with a new vocabulary in terms of financial literacy. So at the end, we're, you know, if all they get from this is that they now understand what a credit rating is, what compound interest does, its benefits, its dangers, if that's what they get from this, then I think it's a success.
Why did you decide to include credit in the scope for this? Given that there's, you know, they're 7 to 10, they're not going to be getting credit anytime soon. Why seed that versus other going doubling down on other more core competencies that might be more relevant to their age group?
Small correction for you, Bruce. Yeah, it's grade 7 to 10.
Grade 7 to 10.
Yeah, not ages 7 to 10.
I apologize.
That's no problem. So when you look at grade 7 to 10, we really think that that's where students first start to have a personal relationship with money.
Right.
So in grade 7, you're probably getting an allowance, maybe looking at babysitting, paper routes. And then by grade 10, you're getting
no one
first
has a
job.
Paper route anymore, by the way.
I was about to correct myself on that one, Bruce.
You grew up in the 60s?
I had a paper route. I'm not that old, but I guess they're obsolete now. So maybe they're like monetizing their YouTube and Instagram feeds.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah,
Something like
grade
that.
7, by grade 10, you should have your first job.
Sarah, where does this fit for Meridian, and what is next for Meridian in this broader education mandate? Is there more to come?
Yes, certainly. So the last several years, we've been partnering with the National Financial Literacy Leader, Jane Rooney, and the Consumer Agency of Canada, really to really understand this issue and to make sure that we're developing solutions like this with key partners like the Learning Partnership, based on the data, with thorough focus groups, all of the above. So this solution is for grades 7 to 10. For grades 11 and 12, we've also been developing a comedy show touring to 400 high schools across Ontario.
I'm available.
Called Funny Money.
Oh, that's James Cunningham.
James Cunningham.
Amazing. He's better than I am.
Yeah. And you're welcome to come to those shows, Bruce.
But I have to buy a ticket. Listen, thank you very much for taking the time to come and talk to us about this. Sarah Ray from Meridian Credit Union and Ian Hartland from the Learning Partnership. The game is called Save the Camp, and you can download it at any place you get any other app you're interested in.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There is a lot of discussion about a regulatory change that could eliminate what are called embedded fees in Canada. Some industry players argue that the change will make financial advice unaffordable for many. Not so fast, says our next guest. John DeGuy is a portfolio manager with Industry Alliance Securities, and he joins us now. Hello there.
Hi there.
Summarize the potential change for people who are not in it to win it on regulatories.
So this has been going on, first off, for over 20 years, off and on, as a discussion as to what to do about embedded compensation, and I would prefer to call them embedded commissions. The problem is that the industry is set in its ways, and they're making a lot of money. A lot of people make a lot of money being fat and happy by recommending products and not talking about how and how much the advisor gets paid when recommending a product to the clients. And as a result, there's a certain amount of, ask me no questions and I'll tell you no lies sort of attitude where consumers are almost willfully ignorant of how and how much their advisor is being paid. And as a byproduct of that, they end up buying things that are not necessarily best for them, but rather are more remunerative for the advisor. And because the topic never comes up, they're oblivious to it all.
And the argument on that side is essentially that if you exclude it, if it's not embedded and people have to fork out the cash for it, they will be unable or that advisors will be unwilling to serve the smaller clients. Is that the essence of it?
Yeah, that's the essence, and it's complete poppycock.
Okay, I was going to say you don't agree. Why? But I like so you're calling it poppycock. Why?
It's hogwash. It's so as I say, four quarters does not cost more than a dollar, and how you pay has absolutely no impact on how much you pay. And so affordability, because what we're talking about here is affordability, is unchanged. Whether you pay it transparently or whether you pay it in an embedded format, you're paying the same amount, and if you can afford to pay one way, then you can just as easily afford to pay the other.
Right. You have written about this. You call the UK experience, a market that has done this, a smoking gun. You're calling the UK experience a smoking gun, showing that advisors are motivated more by compensation than by product merit when making recommendations to clients. When the compensation filter is removed, they actually do the right thing. Tell me more about that.
So what has happened in one of the problems about, and I know you've talked about this in previous podcasts, is that right now what we're dealing with is the fallout and the aftermath for CRM2, the second phase of the client relationship model, where clients are finally being told what their return is, at least over 1 year, and what their advisor and advisor's firm is being paid for the advice that they give. Again, for the first time ever starting this year, what they are not being told on their statements is how much the products cost. Mm. And so it's sort of like imagine going to a garage and getting your muffler fixed. And before you get the muffler replaced, the garage will give you an estimate and say the muffler is going to cost you $89 and labor is going to cost you $120. That's $219 plus tax. Please initial here and we'll begin work right away.
Right.
That's not what's happening with regard to mutual funds. We're finally, in 2017, disclosing how much the cost of the advice is, but we still, other than what was disclosed in a prospectus that some people got 15 years ago and didn't understand and didn't read anyway, there is no similar disclosure with regard to how much the products cost. And surprise, surprise, those that pay an embedded compensation tend to be the highest cost products, and those that don't tend to be the lowest cost products. And that's even when you back out the compensation, which is to say, holding compensation constant at zero, the difference in price might still be a full 1%. Advisors have a preference to not give their clients a bill, and so they end up using their products that have a higher cost so that they don't have to give them a bill. And then the clients pay not only for the advice, which might be fair and reasonable, might not be, but it might be, but then they also fairly unambiguously pay a fair bit more than they would otherwise have to for their products because the advisors
right.
don't want to give them a bill.
So is it the mutual fund companies that stand to take a hit here? Because if costs go down, if an advisor chooses a lower cost product without a productivity improvement, someone's profit is going to take a hit.
Yeah, three legs to a stool. So there's the client, there's the advisor, and there's the product manufacturers. And all three of them have to find ways to decide, you know, what's the cost to one party is there a profit to the other, for instance, right? So you've got to figure out the client in the end is paying for both the cost of the advice and the cost of the product. And when you unbundle and you have the advisor pay charge separately for the advice and then charge separately for whatever products he or she uses in operationalizing that advice, it very quickly moves you to a product meritocracy where the best products are the ones that will be recommended because the advisor is no longer joined at the hip and only recommending from that more limited list of those products that, that pay an embedded compensation. So what happens is advisors, and this is what we found in the UK when they came out with their changes, which was called the RDR, the Retail Distribution Review, was that as soon as advisors no longer had the option of using embedded compensation products, they very quickly, like almost instantaneously, within a couple of quarters, started using the lower cost products because now they could actually pass the savings on to their clients and they'd still get paid either way.
So is it as simple as that, why advisors don't push lower cost options now? Because they'd stand to lose.
Yeah, it's not quite that simple. That's one. I would say that's the main reason. There's also just inertia. There, people just don't like change, and so there's that. There's a certain amount of. I was actually speaking at a conference in Ottawa last week. There was the annual conference for the Canadian Institute of Financial Planners, and I spoke to some of my peers, and I called them on it, how a lot of them are just not facing the evidence. The evidence is overwhelming that the very large majority of high-cost, actively managed products underperform their benchmark over time. These are people who have spent their entire careers telling their clients that that's not the case, in spite of the evidence. It's like they're global warming deniers. Like, you can't deny the evidence when it's that blatant, and it's been around for, the evidence has been in existence for a couple decades now. But the problem is they've now told their clients one story, and the evidence points to a rather different story. And, of course, you can come clean and do what's right, but doing so requires that you admit that you were less than forthcoming in the first place. And a lot of people don't want to have that. So there are a number of reasons. There's product merit, there's compensation and how and how much you get paid and how transparent you are. But there's also sort of the baggage of what you've said in the past and how you can reconcile that with the evidence that's becoming more and more prevalent.
Is your business fee-based mainly?
Yes.
Would your view be different if you were a commission-based advisor, do you think?
Sure. Commission-based advisors, take...
Because they're kind of jammed. They're jammed.
I have nothing against commission-based advisors of and by itself. I have nothing... I'm not opposed to people who do good work, and most advisors do good work, deserve to be paid for it. And as long as they're paid fairly... then the how is a secondary concern. The problem is that when you're paid fairly, but you're giving compromised and conflicted advice because you're recommending products that are not necessarily best for the clients, and so that then becomes a problem. Of and by itself, let's put it this way: if the products that currently pay commissions didn't, and the products that currently don't pay commissions, advisors would almost certainly change their product recommendations, which is to say advisor recommendations are driven primarily by the embedded compensation that exists or does not exist with their products rather than the merit of the products themselves.
Yep, which kind of makes sense. If I was working at a retail store and I knew I was getting paid much more for one pair of pants versus the other, it would be hard to look at the client and say, "You look amazing in the pants that I'm not going to get paid for." It'd be hard. John, I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Bruce.
John DeGuia is a portfolio manager with Industrial Alliance Securities. Well, stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, Ask Anything, we'll get to a listener question on how to best spend your hard-earned retirement savings. Yeah, you have to spend them at some point. But next, buying life insurance online. You'd think that's very 2011, but you'd be wrong. It is finally launching in Canada. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry on Facebook. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
This is Moolala, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. I'm Bruce Ellery. Amazon.com was founded in 1994. The move towards online products and services began in earnest 20 years ago. So you certainly could not say that the insurance industry has been an early adopter. But now you can actually buy a life insurance policy online from a robo-advisor called Invisor. Dan Poole is the company's COO. Thanks for joining us, Dan. How you doing?
I'm great, Bruce. Thanks very much for having me.
What on earth has taken you so long?
Well, we've been working at this for quite some time, Bruce. And as you can imagine, you know, we're positioned as an advisor, which means we don't actually create the products themselves. And when my partner Pramod and I founded Advisor 3 years ago now, we started looking for insurance companies that would be able to give us access to an online product that we could put on our portal and offer to our clients. And it took us a long time to find one, but we have, and we're very happy to have partnered with Teachers Life.
It's called Advisor Term Life. Very briefly, how does it work?
It starts with a quick needs analysis that our users can go through on our site at advisor.ca that helps everybody identify how much insurance they might need or want. From there, they can get a quick quote where they see a snapshot of different products at different prices so they can do a comparison. And if they decide to purchase, they can go through a fully digital online questionnaire to help evaluate their eligibility. And basically, if they're approved, they can buy right online, pay with a credit card through secure links with VersaPay, and they're issued their policy immediately.
If it's all online, where do I courier my vial of blood?
Yeah, that's the great thing about the online products, Bruce, is there are, in the industry, we say there are no fluids. So there's no blood tests required, no...
You don't need to go into details. I get the point. Yeah.
No underwriting.
So there is no now. So that it is simply based on the health questions that are asked as a part of the process.
That's right, and it's a smart engine. So it's called a reflexive underwriting engine, and what that means is that based on the answers that you give to the questions, it may dig a little deeper, and then the system basically makes the underwriting decision on behalf of the insurance company. So it decides if it wants to make an offer or not.
Why is the maximum 500 grand?
Well, that's just the limit that at this time that the companies are comfortable going up to without actually getting the involvement of a human underwriter or somebody who should look at the application a little bit more carefully and perhaps order those tests that you referred to earlier.
This is a pretty big purchase for people, not necessarily in dollar terms, but in conceptual terms, because you have to think through your own mortality. When we bought our first, well, our only term life insurance policy, I actually needed a lot of handholding. How do you handle that in an online world? Are there like cheering emojis? Can you send me an MP3 of "It's going to be fine, Bruce"?
Yeah, we try and use very soothing color palettes on all of our websites to make sure that people feel comfortable. But, you know, seriously, we from the start of the inception of the company have recognized that whether it's investments or insurance, people want to know that they're backed up with human advisors and somebody they can talk to if they have questions or they're not sure. So we make the process as easy to get through as possible, but the support is always there by a licensed advisor in the case of insurance or a registered securities advisor. So if you're feeling stuck or you're not sure, we are really just a call or a click away.
Mm. What's in it for the consumer to go the robo route? And I ask because Advisor does investing in a robo way, so the fee is lower through your app than it would be if you were to have a full service advisor at a investment firm or something like that. But in this case, is it lower cost to the consumer?
I think in terms of overall cost, we could say it's a lower cost. But, there's important elements to cost, one of which is the premium that the client would pay. And again, the premium is set by the insurance company and it's very competitive, but I wouldn't say that the primary advantage is that you're going to save an awful lot of money by buying a product online as opposed to going with a traditional product. But the other element of cost is the time cost that's involved. And as you alluded to, the emotional cost. Do you really want to have a kitchen table conversation with somebody about your medical history? Would you rather do that in the privacy of your own home and do that online? So if we can help people overcome that reluctance to have those discussions and give them the ability to do it online where they might be more comfortable because of the anonymity, then to me that takes away an awful lot of the element of cost, that results in procrastination. And then people end up not making that buying decision, and that can be very costly.
It's a very different positioning then from your other business.
It's different in some ways, although, as financial planners, we believe that risk management applies not only to the investment decision, but to the other risks that people have, the risks that they can't go to work tomorrow, the risks that they die prematurely. And so, risk management and assessing insurance needs has always been an important part of the financial planning discussion, and that's why we decided to put the two together.
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense from a business perspective. I just, from a consumer standpoint, if they're not getting the big cost savings that they get from robos on investments, it seems like a tougher sell.
Oh, I see. And yeah, so you know, we've addressed that in a couple of different ways. One is that in addition to the Invisor Term Life product that we launched, you know, 2 weeks ago, we do offer the other products that are available through the other companies. So if people feel more comfortable going a traditional route, we're happy to help them through that process and buy insurance through a non-online method. So in that case, we would be like any other insurance advisor that they would work with. Mm. But if they prefer a digital option, we offer that.
I've tried a bunch of online services recently, a home valuation, like value your price of your home, getting the best rate on a GIC. I've tried a whole bunch of them, and almost all of them turned out to be lead generation tools. So I'd get an email or a phone call from someone who's basically doing it the old school way. Is this a lead generation tool?
Invisor Term Life is not a lead generation tool. I mean, it truly is a way for people to purchase an insurance policy online. You know, we may contact them afterwards to make sure they're happy with their purchase. We offer them the opportunity to talk to us, but we're not. It's not a product where you can only get so far in the process and then you get kicked offline and you get a phone call from an advisor. It truly can be, the purchase can be made without talking to anybody.
How much do you make on an average term life policy? And so a monthly term life policy would be what, like $100 for a regular person, something like that?
It could be around that. Yeah,
around that ish. And so,
side, sure.
And I ask because one of the things you have been great at doing and all of the robos have been great at doing is being fully transparent on the fees that you charge. So if we bring that to the life insurance world, how much would you make on an average policy, or what's the right way to think about it even?
Yeah, you know, I think the insurance industry, as you mentioned, is still lagging behind the investment industry in a number of different ways, and one of those is compensation disclosure, and that may change in the coming years. But at this point, the insurance companies still do not disclose the compensation that's paid to the advisor. So it truly is embedded in the premium that's paid by the client.
But how much would you make if I'm paying $100? How much of that would go to Invisor?
So the rule of thumb is typically that an insurance policy will pay, you know, roughly the first year premium on the policy would be paid to the advisor in the form of a commission. So that's a standard, you know, average term life insurance policy.
So like $1,200.
$1,200 a year. Yeah, that's right. Then roughly $1,200 in commission would go to the advisor as a first year commission. That's on a standard product. Now, we don't subscribe to that type of compensation arrangement with the partner that we're working with for Invisor Term Life. We've moved to more of a levelized compensation structure. So basically, as long as the policy stays in force, the advisor gets paid, but it doesn't have that whack of front-end commission. At the end of the day, though, Bruce, it's still a competitively priced product. It still offers a great, you know, convenient service to the client. It's just compensation is not something that really is a factor in the consumer decision right now.
No, it isn't, but I hope it will be, and I hope you'll put it in as a part of your FAQ for Invisor Term Life. Can I extract that promise from you?
That's a great suggestion. We will.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Because, of course, I'm advocating that consumers ask every professional service that they consume what the fees are. We're starting to do it on investing. We need to be doing it on property, on home, on accounting, on tax, on lawyers, on everything. And then we'll just all know. Be so easy. Dan, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Dan Poole is the COO of Invisor. He was joining us to talk about Invisor Term Life. Stay with us. Coming up, ask anything. You saved smartly now in retirement. How do you spend smartly? And later, how's this for clickbait? The top 5 lies clients tell their divorce lawyers. You won't want to miss that. Hey, I've written some books, no lies in any of my books. You can order them online. First is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things with Their Money and What You Can Do About It. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We spend a lot of time talking about how to save for retirement. How much do you need? How do you take advantage of RRSPs and TFSAs, all that stuff. But what happens when the saving is done? and only spending remains. The listener question on Ask Anything today is, how do I manage decumulation? John Degue is a portfolio manager with Industrial Alliance Securities. Hello there, John.
Hi there, Bruce.
I love this term. Explain it for people who might think it's a very chewy word to get out of your mouth.
Decumulation?
Yeah.
So decumulation is when you have presumably retired, so you're no longer earning money, and therefore you have to live off your savings for the remainder of your life, however long that may be. And for most people, that means at a minimum, well, for lucky people, it means taking your pension if you have a workplace pension. And of course, for virtually everyone, it means collecting Canada Pension and Old Age Security. But for most people, the main driver of how to manage their decumulation is to convert their RRSP to a RIF, converting their Registered Retirement Savings Plan to a Registered Retirement Income Fund, which must be done no later than the year in which you turn 71. And that's when you actually have a situation where you are prescribed by law, where you are mandated to take money out at a certain level. You can take out more, but you may not take out less. And that's the management that most people have to deal with when they talk about decumulation.
What needs to change about your mindset? Because I can imagine, especially for boomers moving into this phase now, they've saved for years and years and years. They have saved. Now this is a different, it's just a different point of life. The personal finance skills are slightly different. How, with your clients, do you advise them about that shift mentally?
Three things that have to change, and two of them are negative and one of them is positive. The two that are negative, we have to realize that returns going forward will be lower than what they have been in the past, and there are a number of reasons for that. There are, you know, monetary policy reasons and demographic reasons and so forth, productivity reasons, but suffice it to say that returns going forward will be lower than they were previously, so that's one thing that you have to think of. The second thing that you have to think of is also demographic. We're all living longer. So, the old saw, if I'd have known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. And there's a whole generation of people that are sort of shocked that they're still alive because, the advances that we've made with nutrition and medicine and what have you. So that's the other thing that you have to think of. And that's also a negative. It's good that you live longer. But the negative part, of course, is that you have to pay for that longer life. And the longer your life, the more money you need. The one thing that's positive, however, and there was a book that came out a couple of years ago called The Real Retirement, which is co-authored by Fred Vitesse and Bill Morneau. Vitesse is the chief actuary at Morneau Chappell, and Bill Morneau, many of your people would, your listeners would know, is the current Minister of Finance and the former CEO of Morneau Chappell. And what they showed quite resoundingly is that the old rule of thumb that people used to use in financial circles, that you needed to replace 60-80% of your income of what you were earning when you were working in retirement is simply not true, and that the actual number is more like 50%. And in some instances, if you're depending on your income, maybe even lower still. And that's because you really don't have to replace your income. What you have to replace are your lifestyle costs. So, you can't substitute. You have to eat. You have to pay your property taxes. But a lot of the expenses that you incurred when you were working, putting your kids through school and braces and piano lessons and hockey and all
that. And it might pay us a lot of Botox. I got a lot of facial maintenance happening. I won't have to pay for that.
Exactly. But also, paying for your mortgage, presumably once you've retired, your house is paid off and you'll be in a lower tax bracket. So although you're not making as much, you're keeping a higher percentage of what you're making. You're not putting money into CPP and OAS. You're taking money out. You're not putting money into your RSP. You're taking money out. And when you account for all these different variables, in the end, a lot of us work our tails off and we think it's never going to end. And it's probably artificially hard on working people. I think public policy does that. But ironically, once you reach retirement age, which I'm going to say is, let's say, about 65, at that point, things get a whole lot easier because you've paid all your debts. The kids have hopefully left the nest, although lots of people listening, I'm sure, would hope their 30-year-old would move out of their basement. But, there's, for the most part, the kids have left. And
now you get a discount at Tim Hortons and Shoppers
and
Drug Mart.
Tim Hortons to kick it all up. Exactly.
Yeah. Now, assets can be in a lot of different places. You mentioned an RSP. Some people might have non-registered. Let's park pensions to the side for a second. How do you advise people in terms of they've got something in the RSP, the TFSA, non-registered? How do you determine where it should come from and when?
The first thing that you should think of is when do you want to start taking your Canada pension plan? And one of the things, I was at a conference in Ottawa just last week, and one of the speakers was showing that one of the easiest things that most people can do to maximize their retirement income is defer when they start taking Canada pension plans. So as a refresher, the 100% is when you get your payment starting the month that you turn 65, but you can take less and you get paid 0.6% less for every month that you start earlier, all the way down to 30% less if you start on your 60th birthday. Or you can take your CPP money later and get 0.7% per month later, which is to say you can get 135% of your normal entitlement if you wait until your 70th birthday. And the easiest thing that people should do is wait before they start taking their CPP benefits, because it's a guaranteed return of 0.7% per month for the rest of your life, which is, 8.4% per year. It's a pretty good bump in your return. So if you wait before you start getting your CPP money, that's one thing that you can do. Similarly, you can wait if you work longer before you convert your RSP to a RIF. You have to do so by age 71, but some people like to convert at age 65. Well, if you're still working, or if you, have other sources of income, perhaps you can wait. The other thing that I would tell people to do, though, is they should try to find ways to stay in a lower tax bracket. So if you've got money in an RSP or a RIF and you're required to take at least a minimum out, but you need a little more money, but more money would put you into a higher tax bracket, maybe you can supplement your income by doing a small liquidation of assets in your taxable account, or maybe making a small withdrawal from your TFSA, which is totally tax-free. So there are things that you can do, but think of the tax implications as well. And so sort of not only what is your income, but what is your income need, but what is your after-tax income need? Because there are ways of getting income that are a little more tax-effective.
What's your opinion on annuities?
They're great if you think you're going to live to be 100. They're awful if you're going to live to be less than 80, and they probably make sense if you're going to live to be into your mid-80s, but or longer. But if you are thinking you're going to pass away at, say, 81 or 82, chances are you'd be better off using something else.
One final question. What do you recommend for people who want yield these days? Aside from funding their grandchild's grow up?
Right. Well, one of the things that I've been telling my clients for the past 5 or 6 years, I guess going back to the spring of 2011, is that bonds and bond type investments are all the reverse beauty contest. What you're doing is you're trying to find things that are the least ugly, because there's nothing that's actually attractive. I guess the main thing that I tell them is that get used to the fact that real returns are zero. And you heard correctly, the 30-year Government of Canada bond is paying about 2%, and inflation in Canada is about 2% and has been since the early 1990s and is projected to be for the next 25 or 30 years. And so what you're getting is, when you're looking for yield, what you're getting, you need to recalibrate your expectations. What you're getting is just enough to keep pace with inflation. You are doing absolutely nothing to enhance your purchasing power, and that is likely true for everyone listening to your podcast, including people that are only in their early or mid-50s like me.
Thank God Tim Hortons offers that discount. John, I appreciate your insight. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
John DeGooey, Portfolio Manager with Industrial Alliance Securities. Stay with us. Coming up next, things about adultery you probably didn't know when it comes to divorce. This is not an interview with the Ashley Madison people. It is not. They're advertising, by the way, on billboards in downtown Toronto. I was kind of shocked when I saw it, which makes me think I'm becoming my grandmother. John DeGooey will be here. He answers the Moolala questionnaire coming up. And you can subscribe to the podcast version of the radio show. Just check it out on iTunes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Ellery. You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. The website BuzzFeed is famous, or infamous, for its headlines. They call them clickbait because of how enticing they are. I think BuzzFeed may have been involved in the writing of this book's table of contents. The top five lies clients tell their lawyers and things about adultery you probably didn't know. These are but two of the eye-catching chapters in a new book called The Path to a Successful Divorce. The book's author, Russell Alexander, joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Okay, I'll bite. What didn't I know about adultery?
What didn't you know?
It relates to divorce.
The biggest thing you should know in Ontario is there's no fault system. So everybody gets excited when they talk about adultery and divorce, and some people
because they think it's going to be helpful if they were the one who didn't do it.
They're going to be compensated for some perceived wrong, or there's going to be some unequal sharing because of the other spouse's conduct. And the court doesn't care much about adultery or fault. It's a very legislative system of sharing.
Right. Now, we're a national show in other jurisdictions. Is it a similar view, or is it
very similar throughout the country, especially under the Divorce Act, which is federal legislation? They've essentially removed fault from the system.
So you may feel like you've got a moral victory, or at least more sympathy from your friends, but it doesn't help you in the proceedings.
No.
The top five lies clients tell their lawyers. What are some of those lies?
To understand the lies and why lawyers find them telling is you need to understand some very basic concepts in family law. First of all, full and frank disclosure is the ordinary course. So we're talking about income. We're talking about assets. We're talking about a party's conduct and role during the marriage. So people start lying about that, thinking they're going to get some advantage. Maybe somebody's got a cash income from a side job, so they're not going to tell their lawyer about that. Or they have some assets they've received from a family member or somebody else. They're going to hide that so they don't need to share it with their spouse. Those are the big ones. And there's other lies they tell, such as the role that they played during the marriage or the role that the spouse played.
From an income perspective? Or
even a parenting role.
Okay.
Or what responsibility.
Like who did the dishes?
Yeah, that could be part of it because it ties into support. Whether somebody had an ability to earn an income, or why somebody went off to get a university degree or stay at home and raise the kids, or why they made certain decisions as a family unit. So people lie to their lawyers and to their spouses and their spouses' lawyers about these things, thinking they're going to gain some type of an advantage or to try to seek redress of harms they perceived occurred during the course of the marriage.
What's your responsibility as a lawyer to point out a lie that your client may have told?
We have a responsibility to the court. So we need to put evidence before the court that we know is proper and truthful. So our responsibility to the client and to the court is to ensure their financial statements are accurate, that they're not misleading the court. Oftentimes, when people tell lies about those things, it creates more problems, causes delay, and increases the expense to everybody
involved.
So
are those the consequences? I was going to ask. If a lie is discovered, you do not want that to be discovered in front of a judge.
Well, your case is going to go badly. You're going to lose credibility. The judge will probably not accept other statements you have to make about other situations or other parts of your case. And it could result in the court ordering costs against you to pay to your spouse.
How do you communicate that message to a new client when you meet them?
As soon as they come in the office, we talk about concepts involved in divorce, sharing, disclosure. Once they learn these concepts, they understand that if they give us accurate information, we have a better chance of getting an accurate and fair result for them.
Do you give them examples? Like, for example, last week someone lied to me about...
Well, if they one glaring example would be if you look at their financial statement and they have $65,000 in expenses, but they're reporting to the court and Canada Revenue Agency that their income's $15,000. The first question a judge will ask me if I'm their lawyer, how are they paying $65,000 in expenses with $15,000 in income?
Right.
So right off the bat, you're sort of behind the eight ball, you're playing catch up, and you've lost some credibility with the court. So we explain this to them as we're going through their documents and as we're structuring their case and also as we're giving them legal advice in terms of the most efficient and fair way to resolve their divorce.
Another top five list, this time, top five ways to keep costs down. What are the most important ones there?
This ties into this underlying premise of full and frank disclosure. So come put your cards on the table. Be fair about the roles that you played during the course of the marriage, whether it's as a breadwinner or a parent. Be fair about your responsibilities in terms of parenting. Be respectful to your spouse. So a lot of people are hurt. They're angered because they're going through a divorce. Mm. So they'll try to throw their spouse under the bus. Mm. Or they'll say disparaging things about their spouse, which they would never say if they were married, thinking they're going to gain some kind of advantage. This increases your costs. People are going to get adversarial. We're going to have to see the judge. We're going to have to go to court. If you're fair and respectful, it's going to help you control your costs, and it's going to help your lawyer manage your case and your expectations.
You write about how one finds a good divorce lawyer, and I want your opinion on that. But first, how do you define what good is? Because good for one person is not the same for another. In particular, if you want someone to go nuclear on your soon-to-be ex-spouse, right, good is very different than it's uncontested. Let's, you know, sort it out as quickly and as amicably as possible.
My definition of a good lawyer is somebody you can communicate with and have trust in and have a relationship with. So if you feel that you can express your goals and interests to your lawyer and they're listening to you and they're compassionate and they understand what your needs are, they're going to do a good job for you in trying to get you the result that they think would be an appropriate outcome. In terms of getting a good lawyer, gut checks is always a good starting point. When you meet somebody, go with your gut. This is somebody I can trust. This is somebody I can communicate and tell my most private secrets to. Looking towards friends and family members in the community who've been through a divorce. They may have not liked their lawyer, but they may have thought their spouse's lawyer did a fantastic job and refer their spouse's lawyer to them. And just speaking to members of the legal community. It's a small community. There's a handful of lawyers who exclusively do family law, and there's lawyers who do all kinds of laws very well.
I have the utmost respect for you and your colleagues who do this type of work because I know I couldn't do it. Why do you do it?
I think
there are lots of areas of law you could have chosen to practice.
I think it gives lawyers a real opportunity to help people in crisis. If you think about somebody going through a divorce, many things that are very important to them in their lives are on the table. Their property, their income, their home, their relationship with their children, how their relationship with their children is going to look like in the future. When their child goes to get married, are they going to be able to walk their daughter down the wedding aisle together? Or are they going to be fighting still with their spouse? So you have a chance to help people through that stage of their life. And you have a chance to do it in a very compassionate way and make changes in people's lives in real terms.
Russell, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me in today, Bruce.
Russell Alexander is the author of The Path to a Successful Divorce. The Moolala Questionnaire. It is our series of questions about money, about life a little bit. I'm going to ask John DeGuey, a portfolio manager with Industrial Alliance Securities, the first thing, John, that comes into your mind. Are you ready?
Okay.
How would you describe your money personality?
The first, appropriate.
Appropriate. But, wow, you sound very British. Really, are you from you. British stock? Very appropriate.
That's the first word that popped into my mind, which sucks for you because it doesn't really give you a lot to work with. What I would say is that everyone should have an attitude toward money that suits their disposition, and I think my attitude suits mine, not surprisingly. And for the record, I'm aggressive, but I'm not goofy. Like, I don't take unnecessary risk, but I take appropriate, balanced, judicious risk with my portfolio.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Toronto Maple Leafs season tickets.
Ooh, nice, nice. What is one money topic you could write about or talk about every single day?
The awful state of regulatory reform in Canada. In fact, I literally have written a book about it. In fact, I've updated it. The fourth edition just came out a few months ago. So it's called The Professional Financial Advisor 4, and it does talk about how ridiculously slow the pace of reform has been in Canada. There are a lot of things that can and should be done to help protect consumers and professionalize the industry. Mm. And the good news is we're making progress. The bad news is I've been writing about it for 20 years, which means if we'd have done it when we should have, I could have stopped writing 20 years ago.
Right. Okay, so what is one topic you wish you never, ever, ever had to write about ever again? You can't choose the same one, because then I would call you insane. If you say regulatory reform, I would call you insane.
Yeah. I would never have to write about again. Now, before I answer that question, is that because I hate it or because I just want it to go away? And if we could just solve this problem, it would be great, because I would never have to write about it.
You get to decide.
Okay, so I would love to put an end to embedded compensation in Canada, and so that I would never have to write about it, because I'm constantly writing articles, but also letters to the editor, because there's just a slew of misinformation out there that certain stakeholders who purport to be looking out for consumers are putting forward, when in fact they are wolves in sheep's clothing that are really just feathering their own nest.
Letters to the editor thing. That's old school. That's old school.
Yeah.
I like it. It's good.
Yeah.
When do you plan to retire, and what will you do?
I plan on slowing down.
Oh my gosh, you've never given any thought to this question.
No.
You're a portfolio manager. You're a CFP, and you have never thought of this question.
No, I certainly have. I intend to work full time until I'm 65, and to be fully retired by the time I'm 70. So the answer to my friend Jonathan Chevreau co-wrote a book with a guy named Mike Drack
Victory Lap.
Years ago. Yeah, called The Victory Lap Retirement, and I subscribe to it. So I want to work full time till I'm 65, and then slowly phase out until I'm 70, and then I'm going to be out at age 70. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to watch a lot of Jeopardy and watch a lot of Leaf games, and keep on winning hockey pools. And
you're going to get fat.
No, I'm not. I'm not going to get fat.
You've mentioned nothing about physical activity. All you're doing is watching television.
I go for power walks now. Still, I've actually lost a bit of weight. I think I'm probably in the 90th percentile in terms of fitness for people my age.
All right, okay. Good. You should add that in when you talk about your retirement. Otherwise, people are going to think you're going to get fat, just like I thought. If you could snap your fingers, I'm watching you. Snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be? I'm going to do the snap like that.
It would be the excessive use of credit card debt.
Yeah. Did you ever have trouble with that, or were you just born virtuous?
I had trouble, but not because I spent too much, but rather because I earned too little back in the day.
Back in the day. Well, you have reformed that. That's a regulatory change. John, thank you for your time, for your insight, for your candor. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. All the best.
Okay, take care. John DeGuy, Portfolio Manager with Industrial Alliance Securities. That is our program for today. Thank you very much for joining us. To listen to past episodes, you can head on over to iTunes. They are archived there. Segments are also available at moolala.ca, so you can choose just the one that you want to listen to, if that's your choice. You can send us questions, comments, whatever, to ask at moolala.ca. At Bruce Selry on Twitter, Facebook, Bruce Selry Moolala. Thank you so much for living. Well, thanks for living, yes, and for listening, too. Have a great day.